Hey everyone, welcome to the Basketball Victoria Talking Split podcast. I am Rob Calder. With me, I have the high performance coaches for Country and Metro, Justin Schuler, Mike Zeppel. Welcome, guys.
Robbie.
Podcast number 22 today, Robbie, just for those keeping count.
None of us were, but it's a miracle we've got to this point.
Season 3.
Says a lot about our ability to push through bad content, maybe, or just maybe we've got a lot of friends that are very kind that will go and listen.
Thursday afternoon in the BV office.
It is.
Big response, though, from last week.
It is, and we're probably going to touch on that just a little bit to start off the pod. But before we start, obviously, same as last week, we had some great interaction on the social media platforms out of last week. So Twitter, you can get us on that. Facebook, share, like, retweet. Ratings, review on iTunes as well. Any feedback that you can give to us is fantastic. It obviously helps us to produce a little bit of content. And the content we got over the course of the week was fantastic on the back of our chat with Eric Hollingsworth, the high performance manager at Melbourne United. So again, big thanks to Eric for jumping on. I'm sure he's a loyal listener now and friend of the show. He's been on once.
He's definitely asking what the stats were like after that pod. He wants to know that he was the number one. So
it's amazing how many people ask that. They assume there's a massive spike in numbers when they come on the podcast. It's not always the case.
It was last week.
You know, Eric was fantastic, and I know I had yet another trip down to Geelong over the weekend. So from my end, it was great to be able to listen back and just sort of hear what he was saying as well. And I mean, you listen to it the first time, and I think you take a little bit of stuff in, and you're all sort of sitting back and you go, hey, that's a really good point. But it's not until you listen to it a second time, it's like, okay, now I've got to really think about this. And thankfully, I had 2 hours of driving to do, 4 by the time I had to come home, and mine was going a little bit too.
I'm with you. Like, I haven't listened to them all back, but that was one that I went, no, I need to listen to that again, and made notes as I listened, and has definitely put some things in action for us already that I guess we'll touch on in the pod today.
So I haven't re-listened to it, but my head's been spinning since last Thursday, just with things that potentially can happen in our space, what's happening in different sports, different countries, and just what would be maybe the perfect model if we had, you know, all things considered, you know, what would be the perfect model. So definitely generated a ton of talk in our office here too.
One of the things with it is a real self-reflection on,
absolutely,
man, like we're just not where we need to be. And but that's a positive thing, and you know, for any coach, every season you've got to be reviewing where you're at and making a little tweak and moving forward.
You
know, but the thing for me was, you know, Victoria's been known for a long time as being able to produce athletes and you know, get things done, but that competing athletes into development statement he made was exactly it. Like,
you've gone and stolen my quote.
I know,
from
I stole
you,
your quote, but like,
that is harsh.
That one keeps ringing in my head. That, you know, for years coaching in other states, we always just went, oh, well, they've got a better competition. But really, should we have been saying, well, we just got to produce better athletes? And that's the one for me that just has been ticking over in my head nonstop. And something that, yeah, we need to impact and change moving forward.
And not the first time I've heard that as well. I remember Brad Davidson saying that to me maybe 2 or 3 years ago. We were talking, I think it was maybe an under-16 Nationals, and he just said, oh, yeah, but, you know, you guys will be at the pointy end because Victorians are just battle-hardened.
Yeah.
And it's pretty accurate. Like, you think about the amount of games and things like that that we put our kids through, they are. Like, they play so often that they're used to being in pressure situations or a situation or down the stretch that they've seen 3 or 4 times throughout the course of a season or grading or over their career. They're used to this by now.
And having coached in other states, like, it's easier to use that as an excuse. You know, one of the things when I was in Tassie, it used to drive me insane was, you know, Vic Metro would be spoken about before you even got to the tournament. And, you know, my thing was, don't hope to do well, expect to, because if you do the work, you'll have a chance. And, you know, you look at the smaller nation populations in the world, still produce exceptional athletes, exceptional programs. Doesn't matter what size state or what size, you know, basketball draw you've got, if you can produce the best athletes, things are going to take care of themselves from a competition point of view.
I think we've spoken about that a couple of times. I know you're really big on that, Mike. You look at sort of population sizes of certain countries and what they produce, and like, you look at the Slovenias and places like that, they always have good athletes and always have good teams. And why? Like, their population number is so much smaller than some of the other countries, but they're always at the pointy end. So coaching's clearly got something to do with it.
Yep.
And, you know, their model and their pathway has a lot to do with that as well.
All of it. Model, identification, finance, like financial backing. Slovenia's got 2 million people and won the Euro Cup last year,
yeah.
Which is an incredible result for them. Now they've got a roster loaded with NBA players as well. So
about to get another one too, with Doncic coming up.
Absolutely, yeah,
probably
absolutely.
Number one pick now. These coaches,
bit of collusion, you reckon?
Coach is going to be selecting him.
Eric did speak last week about you got to be careful though, just to use population size and the model as the reasoning for you building a model yourself. I think you used the Dutch soccer program, like population of 4 million people, consistently in the final 16 of the World Cup, and then I think they refer to Australia as being the one we tried to adopt their model. When Gus was in charge, but it kind of just didn't work in our environment. So it's just interesting when you do compare, and I'll have a bit of a chat about it later, you know, where we sit and how do we compare to other sports as well.
The thing I love about the conversations I've had since then, it's been more about a solution focused chat versus for a long time I've found in our space it's always been, oh, we don't have funding, we can't do that, or oh, it is what it is, you know, we've always done that, that's what we'll do. Where the conversations this week have really been solution focus, and what if we did this, you know, like how would that look for us, and real thought provoking kind of stuff. And I think if the pod can have that sort of impact, that's really what I guess when we started this thing we wanted was thought provoking ideas and ways to go about it. I know we're going to talk about you know, some questions that coaches put out there, but one of our country coaches who runs one of the programs for us here in Victoria, he's already changed his periodization to fit exactly the same as what we've kind of tweaked, but also said, you know, moving forward, every coach is going to be on that development mindset versus result mindset. And I think that's the biggest thing that is, or the hardest thing that's going to be, is to change the mindset of what is winning. Is winning producing 3, 4, 5 athletes from your club into a state team? Or is it winning the classic? You know, what is the real goal? And until clubs get an understanding of what they're about, and it's okay if some clubs are about winning the tournament and don't care about developing, well, just recruit the best kids every year, and that's how that's going to work. And you know, Eric touched on those conflicts as a challenge for us. But if clubs really adopted the mindset that how many kids I can push through the pathway, I think that's going to be a really good outcome for us if that can be the change moving forward.
It's a dangerous place to live when you use the it's always been done this way, or this is the landscape, this is where we're at. It's a dangerous place to live. And I think all great organisations, programs, businesses, sporting clubs, everything is always up to review, and it's always up to debate, and it's always up to change. And I think that's a safe place to live when you can just always think that, okay, we can do better. Just because it's the way it sits now doesn't mean it's the right way. It's just the way today. And I think like Justin said, if it can stir a little bit of action, and that's the big action, because we can talk about it until the cows come home, but action is where it's at. So to hear that coaches have already started to implement periodization, I got it right, Robbie, like
good
that.
Good job.
Already in their programming is awesome. And Justin and I got in the office on Monday and kind of talked about like what are we doing? Like that was 9 a.m. Monday morning. So it was really, really, really good.
The other thing is action can only come from understanding. So to me, one of the other real clear things that came out of it was what is actually high performance. And the amount of conversations I've had where now we can... And again, you know, Eric spoke about, you know, results should be, again, on individual production, not team production. Mike and I live in that world the whole time. Green and gold athletes is what we're reviewed on, not medals at a national. So you know, that clarity on and that there's a pathway, you know, like we call it NITP, every state's got something, but that isn't high performance, that's state-based development. And we're to the point where we want to change the name on that to really get that clarity around it. The high performance part's that 1-2% of athletes at the top of the tree that have a chance to go on and represent internationally. Does it mean that every athlete in the pathway isn't valuable? No, of course they are. But you know, and to really have our model to cater for the 1% there, that's actually what high performance is, and that's something that we've got to keep getting better at.
I think it's something that gets lost too. Like a lot of the discussion we had last week was not necessarily aimed at the kid that plays domestic basketball that also plays on a Friday night, that really loves the game, but probably isn't going to go on and represent and be a Boomer or an Opal at some point. We're talking about the real pointy end of those athletes, you know, and realistically there's, what, 10, 15 in the state. Like, there's not a heap of them that are getting around there that you identify and say, well, okay, there's actually a chance for this kid to go on and be a very good college player, a very good professional athlete, make money from the sport. That's sort of what we're talking about when we say high performance athletes. It's because there is confusion. I know I've been a part of that a long time as well. I'm all about blowing things up and starting again. But that is certainly something I try and look at fairly regularly. But I've been caught in it myself as a coach, where I've picked the short-term kid and left out the long-term kid. And I look back at it now and think, geez, that was a really bad decision. It helped me win at the time, but it really hasn't progressed the athlete or the sport by making that call as well. But so it is a difficult world and landscape to live in, because as coaches, we are frequently assessed on winning. And you sort of look at it at the end of every VJBL season or country champs and go, geez, that coach always wins. And it's like, well, do they always win because they have the best athletes? Because they coach for the under 14 championships, but then you look at those kids in under 16s and none of them have really progressed. So has that coach really done a good job? And I know the first year I took an under 12s team, I was talking to a coach at state trials and they sort of asked, you know, what are you coaching? I said, oh, under 12s. And he's like, oh, we won't even know if you're a good coach or not until 4 years' time. And it's like, what the hell are you talking about? My team's loaded. I'm really good. He's like, no, no, no. We don't know where your kids will end out. If we won't know if you've picked the right team. We won't know if you've coached in the correct way. We won't know anything until 4 years' time. I look back on that now and it's like, yeah, okay, I get it. Like, it's a different mindset now. As a 12s coach, you're responsible for so much.
And like, selection processes are always subjective. But I heard Kevin Bartlett once talk about he missed out on a team and he put in his mind he was going to do the work to be the best player on the field so that he wasn't actually in conversations on selection. He was just that good that you're selected. And again, you know, if we can have that mindset on how we can help athlete development and that we, they are the best kid, they just get selected, everything else will take care of itself. The challenge we've all got is everyone's got a board or a commission or something that they've got to answer to. And often in, at that level, it is just wins and losses. Like, the value in spending 4 years on athlete development isn't seen as something important. It's, well, help us win now. And so again, it's a cultural thing that clubs are really going to have to look internally about what do they want to stand for. And again, you know, everyone's going to have a different opinion on that. But I think, you know, the debate has been a real good starting point, a little bit of a groundswell on discussion. And now it's probably at the point where hopefully we can talk about some action change and, and things we can implement.
And that was a question that was posed online, Robbie said, around, like, how do you measure your results as a coach if we're not talking about wins and losses? And that's kind of the space I live in right now. So not coaching a team, on the floor 4 nights a week, three nights and a Saturday
morning.
Sleep
a lot better though, don't you? Now that you don't have to worry about the win and the loss, it's much easier.
It's easy. And it's just day-to-day player development. So there's no wins and losses. So I've had to change how I measure not my own success, but the success of what we're trying to do on the floor. And it's just little things around, okay, athlete A has this footwork today. In 6 weeks' time, what does their footwork look like? And that's the 12s and 14s. That's where you live right now, Robbie. But I think it takes some self-reflection and kind of looking at yourself like, okay, how am I actually going to measure exactly what I'm trying to do here? And it can't always be the Friday night result, and probably shouldn't be the Friday night. Probably should never be the Friday night result. It might be helping an athlete achieve a skill or a mindset that they did not have 6 weeks ago, 12 weeks ago.
And that doesn't have to necessarily be the high-performance kid either. Like, that can apply to all levels of coaching. That could be the kid that's playing in kill size under 14 twos, where you sit there and say, hey, I really want this kid to play in their 16 ones in 2 years' time.
Yep.
So that can be the same incremental development that goes through. Like, that doesn't necessarily just have to be high-performance thinking.
And again, from a coaching perspective, you do need to have a team environment to prove that you can game coach. Like, there's no doubt about that. But to me, that shouldn't be in the development pathway. Like, that is your semi-pro level, big V, youth league, your big V league, your Siebel league. Those tiers get to a national championship coach at that level. That's where you can get kind of the runs of the board. I know I talk to coaches all the time about my pathway. And yeah, coach teams the whole way, but really my Australian opportunities only came because we were producing individual talent out of Tassie. Okay. I know that, and that was, you know, like, that was the thing that got the opportunity. So there, it can be done where, you know, people are always trying to move up the tree, and so you should, like, that there's nothing wrong with that. But understanding that, yeah, there is a way to get that done, even if it is just purely about development.
I think you're right. Like, the senior level really is wins and losses. Like, yeah, that's where you, like, the SEABL level, the state champ, the Div 1 men and women, that's probably where you're going to be assessed on your wins and losses.
Yep.
I said it to someone as a bit of a throwaway comment the other day, the best job in basketball is a youth league coach. Like, realistically, the win and the loss does not matter one iota. However, your job is to produce athletes to then go and play in your senior team,
yeah,
after that. And that's your only job.
And see, at the same time, at a CBL or Big V level, part of your mindset should be your program should be able to assist athletes into a national league,
right,
program.
Yep. Right.
Now, again, not every athlete, like CBL, is not high performance, yep, because you're working with part-time athletes, you're working with some athletes that come back, and they are definitely high-performance athletes. So it's a mixed bag. What you can produce is an environment where success is inevitable for each individual athlete. And by that, that'll mean different tiers. You know, for the guy that's working you know, 9-to-5 job and wants to play on the weekend but comes out and is able to have a good CBL career and an impact, you've provided that opportunity to improve. For the guy coming back from an NBL level that's just trying to increase his paycheck because he's going to be a better contributor the next year, you can provide that level. So development is in everywhere in the path, but the, you know, you've got to find your niche and find your way to be able to have that impact.
So we start looking at like some of the questions that came in.
Let's hit them, mate. Hit them.
Like Jared Hillier and Lucas Allen sort of kicked it off a little bit from down at Southern Peninsula. So we do appreciate them jumping into it. But some of the things were, how do we not reduce the amount of games they play, but how do we really push forward skill development if it's not games related? And that is a great question, because we talk a fair bit about, especially in the coaching side of things, small-sided games being the way to produce better athletes, and, yeah, you know, the 2-on-2s, the 3-on-3s, and, you know, was lucky enough to work with Mike McHugh and sit in a lot of his sort of sessions and delivery to coaches, and their big thing was, well, he spoke to his great friend Pesic from over in Europe, and his thing was play 3-on-3. Kids, yeah, touch it more, more decisions, more space, they start to understand areas of the court a little bit more. Small-sided games is not necessarily competition. Like, that is not, hey, the scoreboard says you've lost 41-42. That is teaching them to play and breakdowns. And that's a really big thing, and something I've had to go back to a lot this year with under-12s, is breakdowns. We don't do anything 5-on-0. We don't do anything, you know, that's game-related without breaking it down first. And I think that's a really key point to a lot of coaches out there, that, okay, start with maybe 1-on-0 so that they understand the skill, and once you've got it in, cool, 1-on-1, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5, and then start to build it and push it down that way.
Comes down to periodization. Like, there needs to be a skill acquisition period in your year.
Yeah.
And so if that means that results aren't going your way because you've got that, that has to be there.
Yeah.
And I, you know, again, out of the chat, we spoke about let's change when we actually have that period. And so from a high performance view, we're doing that now.
Yeah.
Because right now is that period of the year where they're not into heavy competition phase yet. It's week to week, but... Yeah. And we can spend more time on that and help develop the individual athlete. Now, there has to be a skill act section. There has to be a physical prep section. There has to be a competition phase. Like that's periodization in a nutshell, where we have those three segments. Again, though, what is the right percentage? Now, if we was talking purely from how do we make an athlete be the best athlete they can possibly be at the end of their pathway, the skill act needs to be a higher percentage. But within that needs to come some game sense, so there's got to be a percentage of that. Within that, they've got a trial and error in different tiers of competition, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a challenging jigsaw to put together. The problem is we've got the percentages around the wrong way. We all identify that. That clearly came out in the mm-hmm. pod.
Yeah.
We've got to figure out a way, instead of it being 80% competition, how can we actually make that, you know, 80-70%, whatever it might be, skill act, and then the rest of the part is competition.
I watch a lot of VJBL, Robbie, and I would hazard a guess that it's not the X's and O's on a Friday night that's winning the under 14.
It's the Jims and Joes.
It's the Jims and Joes. It's exactly the Jims and Joes. It would be interesting to see if someone picked their team in October and just developed kids from October to the following August and then went into VJBL playoffs, how that would happen.
Yep. Without gameplay, you're saying?
Using all of your time
yep.
for skill development and small-sided games and running the most basic kind of action defensive philosophy. Man-to-man, we do this on offense and just trying to develop the best players on the floor. In those 10 months, especially when you're dealing with 14-year-olds, 13, 14-year-olds, they're really going to spike in development because a lot of it's going to be new and clean for them and they'll start to put that into play. Around the periodization, you do have to spend some time in instilling some game strategy with your kids. But if you've got the best players on the floor, the strategy is irrelevant.
It's funny you say that. Siena in Italy, who have won a lot of EuroLeague championships, small town, not very big, kind of coming back with the same themes. But up to under 16s, they would run, the only technical side of things they would work on is a ball screen, because they believe to win in Europe, you have to be able to play out of pick and roll. So that was the only technical part they'd put into their practice environment, but everything else was skilled development. And they had a great history of homegrown athletes being those people that ended up winning those titles. Now, they bring in an American or whatnot, but you know those athletes that they were able to produce all the way through, there was a good outcome. No sniggers on the homegrown
thing. Yeah, I was just looking at you with interest to see where that was going. But you bang on the money. Like I know this year I got my team. First thing I had to do was not teach them to pass, catch, or anything like that. It was to put in a press break. Because by the time we pick our team, in 4 weeks' time, we're in grading. And we need that. Otherwise, we're going to have points run up on us like there is no tomorrow.
And that's that is a major flaw in this whole thing.
Absolutely.
That the first thing you have to do is that. And what that means is that for 4 weeks there, you have to teach all of that technique and schematic stuff for the team, and you cannot just let the kids shoot. Because now, if you would have gone back and filmed those practices and counted the shots that each one of those kids would have shot across a 90-minute practice, it's not 35 shots.
God, no.
So, and that's where we're talking about this, you know, segmenting practices and your year to try and figure out when you're going to develop kids. We've really just got to figure it out. Like, this is where we live right now. Like, this is the issue, but we have to figure out how we're going to help that. You got kids that are under 12, bottom age under 12. In 3 years' time, they're top age 14 with a chance to enter the pathway, but they won't enter the pathway unless they have some kind of predisposed skill set.
Correct.
That's a major thing right there, mate.
And that's something I've had to adapt as well. Like, if I had my time over again with this group, it wouldn't be done that way. And we've gone pretty much into the skill acquisition point probably about a month ago now, where it's just like, hey, we've graded where we graded, don't really care about the wins and losses at this point. This is now all about skill development, and we track how many shots these kids get up during their training sessions, and each kid would probably shoot roughly to 150 to 200 shots per training session with us now, purely because that's what I value. It's like our warm up on a Friday night consists of, when we get the chance, 10 minutes of form shooting, and then we're into layups for maybe 2 minutes just to get the heart rate up.
Yeah.
But it is all skill development, and I think it's the better way to be. Like, I feel comfortable that in 2 years' time, or at the end of this season, when I hand these kids on to the next coach, they'll be in a better place for it.
Eric spoke about this last week too. Like, basketball is a skilled sport. Like, he made point that this is not football and netball. Like, this is a sport that requires a pretty special skill. And if we talk about other sports, and this is what I was thinking about post last week's pod, golf and tennis, also very technical, skilled sports. If you asked an athlete at the age of 10 to just go and play rounds of golf, play, they might shoot 90 on day one, but 4 years later, they're still shooting 90.
That's a good point.
Tennis is the same.
You seem surprised by this.
I'm going to say 85. They're shooting 85.
Okay. That's really...
Might have been windy on the first day.
Still over par. Tennis is the same. Like, you can't just go and play tennis match after tennis match because you'll just wear yourself out. But you do have to stand on the baseline and just crush backhands for an hour. Like, that does have to happen. And the reason why is because biomechanically, they're skills. You have to be very fit to play tennis. We understand that. But they are things that need a ton of work on. The basketball shot is very similar. Like, it is really tough biomechanically. Ask a person who's never shot a basketball before to shoot a basketball and have a look what it looks like. And it's the same as asking someone to swing a golf club who's got no idea how to swing a club. Whereas if you put a ball just out in front of the ground, on the floor, someone can go up and kick it. So that's where the skill act comes into it. Like, this, we're talking about shooting a basketball, and I think we just kind of just throw it away like, oh, it's just a part of the game. It is the game.
No, it's 100%. One of my AFL mates that listened to the pod hit me up and said, if you were going to break down basketball as a decathlete, as Eric spoke about in Fragment, what you actually have to focus on, what would it be? And I just said, well, if you can't shoot, you can't play. Like, in all reality, you can't shoot, you can't play.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was, I thought that was a great way to look at it, is if I've only got, I can only train on one thing at a time, what am I going to spend that time on today? Yeah. You know, and just keep figuring out ways to have that impact on that skill.
And this is not to sort of not value the games either, like, because playing games is an important part of development. Like, we saw the AIS a number of years ago pretty much played no games for the season. They weren't a part of the Siebel League. They were going to tour and ended up not touring. So how did that impact their development throughout the course?
The funniest thing about that is some names that went through in that patch: Ben Simmons, Dante Exum, Jonah Bolden. Three of potentially of our better athletes in recent times. A heavy focus in that period was shooting. Now, granted, Ben and Jonah weren't at the COE for a long period in that time, but Dante definitely was. How many medals, gold medals, did Dante win as a junior? Do you know the answer?
One
gold medal. But he is now an NBA level guard playing in a meaningful team in a playoff.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, straight away, was it the competition? Was it not?
Yeah. And this is what I mean. Like, it is unique competition to test yourself at times, but do you need as much as we currently provide our athletes? Because if you looked at some of our athletes during, I'll just say this week, an under 16 kid that's made a state team, they would probably play on a Friday night. They potentially have a school game. They potentially have a domestic game as well. You throw on top of that two VJBL sessions, two state sessions, and maybe one NITP session or two NITP sessions.
Right.
It's a fairly heavy workload. And how many of those sessions will be better off as skill development rather than team development?
Yeah, absolutely.
Think about the Joel Embiid situation. He played 44 games in 3 years. He played a pretty much a full year, had his rest days and whatnot, and had the orbital injury this year. So he played 70-odd games this year. He played 44 games in the three previous years and out of nowhere became one of the 10 best basketball players in the world and barely played. Okay, so in practice, he would have been competing and they would have managed him in and around his player development stuff, but he didn't play any games. I think when we talk about shooting and getting better at shooting in games without playing games is how you structure drills and how you structure your practice. So we can work on shooting. You do your volume, you do your technique, you do your challenges, you've got to make 10 in a minute, whatever it is. But then we play 3-on-3 with an 8-second clock off a side on ball. And when you catch that ball in the corner, someone helps off you, there's 2 seconds on the clock, you've got to be able to make a shot against the clock with a high hand and a closeout. Now that's game-like and without playing the game. That then translates to the 5-on-5 game when the lights are on and people are in the stands. So there is a real delicate balance between all of it. But the really good coaches and programs find out how to balance all that.
Yep, fully agree.
And what tends to happen is you can do as much form shooting with your kids as you want. As soon as it gets competitive, how quickly those bad habits creep back in again straight away. And it's what you do at that point which dictates which way the player goes. If you sit there and say, hey, you've shot that from your hip, and we've been talking about not shooting it from your hip, but the ball went in, so hey, I'm just going to leave that alone, that's not going to help your athlete. Like, that needs to be reinforced to them as well. Hey, there needs to be a level of transfer from the training drill into the competitive environment as well.
Again, there's a periodization on your shot technique.
Right.
There's got to be form, then there's got to, you know, you got to speed that thing up, and then you got to get competitive and then put into game. Like, everything's got its own cognitive development there at its own rate.
Almost
stuck on it, but you know, my rate may be different to Zep's, and that's the other challenge we've got in our current environment.
Slower,
yeah. Zep's way slower. I'm pretty efficient, but yeah, like, that is the other challenge we've got. Is here, coach, you've got 10 athletes, bring them along in your 1 hour of practice a week.
Yep.
It ain't gonna happen.
Yeah, it's pretty tough.
Yeah,
it's. And it's something everyone experiences. Like, the amount of coaches I talk to and say, you know, how long do you get your kids for? 45 minutes on half court. I thought, well, that's going to be pretty hard. Like, so when I, with my under 12 kids, we usually set them homework, and the homework's nothing spectacular other than shoot 50 foul shots a night, form shoot for 5 minutes every day, you know, spin outs, inside pivot foot, into catch and shoot, those kinds of things. And it's nothing stressful that's going to, you know, hurt them or anything like that, but it is purely to get them used to, hey, I need to go and put work into this every day, otherwise I'm not going to improve. And that's the mentality we're going to try and get to our kids, is you need to do some individual skill work. You won't always have a coach available to you, even at the pro level. Like, you may not always have a coach available to you to work you out. You need to get yourself into that habit.
So the start of this question, which feels like about an hour ago, was how do we reduce games? How do we do that? Like, what is the one, if we said, all right, we get to start Basketball Victoria from scratch today, what would we do?
Would we rehire? We'd rehire Robbie for sure. We'd keep Robbie.
I don't know that you would.
We'd rehire.
We'd
expand your role. We'd expand your role. Just okay. So, yeah. A little bit of research, Robbie, because one of us three does have to do some research and provide some honesty to the audience.
I feel somewhat slighted here.
So Germany has two leagues. So they've got a under-19 league and an under-16 league. The under-19 league is a national league. They call it the NBBL, which is under-19s, 19 and under. And if you're really good junior on the radar, then you play in that. They play a 16-game season. Okay, they have a 6-game preliminary where they kind of sort out who plays against who. And then you play 16 games and a tournament final 8 to win. So you play a total of like 23, 24 games across 52 weeks of the year. And that's all you do. The JBBL is under 16s, and they play a total of 6 qualifying games, and they roll on from that. And if you're in the main draw, so if you're in one of the better teams, you play a 10-game season plus a finals tournament. And if you are in the relegation, when you're in the relegation division, then you play 14. Okay, so they're somewhere in between. The mid-20s is the number that that cohort of athletes in Germany is getting.
And so right now that compares to what in Victoria? 50 plus, 60 plus?
By the time you throw in, say, a pre-season tournament, your grading, your season, probably a mid-season tournament, whether it be National Junior Classic or just something else mid-season, I'd say most teams would probably play around that 40 to 50 games off the top of my head.
And that's across 11 or 12 months, isn't it?
It is, yep.
Which is interesting, because I know the NBA recently brought out their youth basketball guidelines, which was an awesome document.
You've ripped me off royal here, Zeppel, because this is the one bit of research I actually did do for this, but I'll let you continue with
it. No, talk to it, Rob.
Robbie, for the listeners, Robbie, I'm a journalist major. I graduated in journalism. That's called a segue in the business, and I was about to throw over to you.
I thought those are the things you wrote around on at wineries and places like that. But you're bang on the money. Like, the youth guidelines that the NBA produced did bring out this year, and they've got a whole heap of stuff. So youthguidelines.nba.com, I do recommend everyone go and have a little bit of a look
really
at
good.
It. Which is fantastic. So they've got a whole heap of stuff on there about what are the rest guidelines for athletes, what are the recommended participation guidelines for athletes, the maximum participation numbers for guidelines. So there's plenty of stuff on there. So realistically, with the younger age groups, they're obviously suggesting don't overwork them, one session per week. And we're talking like that age from sort of 7 to about 11 years old, one session per week, one game per week. And the big thing, which I thought was really interesting, is given this has come out from the NBA, they're really happy to delay specialisation.
Yes.
There it is. It was going to happen eventually. Delay specialisation in basketball until at least the age of 14. So that, for mine, is interesting straight away. And it sort of ties in a little bit to what Eric was talking about last week. He was sort of saying, look, below the age of 10, let them run a mark. They can do as much stuff as they want. 10 to sort of 12, maybe start to hone in on two sports. And then around about the age of, sort of, I think he said 15 last week, you should really have your one sport locked away, and that's what I'm going to be good at.
That's what he said, yeah.
So really interesting that they've got those out there as well. There's all kinds of rules they have around it as well. So those are such things as, and we have a little bit of this in our junior basketball in terms of, you know, later zone in 12s and 14s and things like that. They've got rules around equal playing time, what type of defense they have to have as well. So it's a fairly structured league. But the onus on that is to preach skill development. Like, they don't want juniors winning tournament. It doesn't help them at all in terms of their development as an athlete. What they really want is the skill development. So they have rules about when can you press, what sort of defense can you play, can you double team, are you allowed to steal the ball? Well, they go right down to that level as well, which is really interesting. So I do recommend everyone go and have a little bit of a look at that. And again, youthguidelines.nba.com. I think it's a great couple of documents on there, because they've got some stuff on there about health, nutrition.
So for a top age under 18 athlete
Yep.
who's year 11 here, so say they're year 10 or 11 in the US,
yep.
how many practices a week?
So they're saying 2 to 3 games per week,
yep.
and 3 to 4 practices per week.
And how many months of the year is that?
That goes for 5 months of the year.
Yeah.
So there's a fair bit of downtime. So obviously that coincides with sort of football season over there as well. So
the sports structure is.
Yeah, that's how their system's set up. And a lot of that's through schools as well. It's not necessarily like a club outside
right.
of their schooling system. That is their school that runs their basketball as well. So there's a fair chunk of downtime in there as well. And it's almost like once you're in basketball season, you're only in basketball season. There's nothing else, and that's kind of what you do.
What's interesting about the downtime is that it is maybe an optimal player development time, Robbie. So for 6 months of the year, you can just get in the gym and shoot. So it's interesting. It's a great document. Definitely jump online and have a look. And they've got a list of all the people that back this.
Yeah,
it's
incredible.
The physicians and biomechanic experts and people, professors that have put work into this document. And for the NBA to release it, it's definitely got some legs.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, I mean, even just basic things like maximum amount of games per year they should be playing. How much rest should you have? So for a grade 9 to 12 in the States, like what's that? What's that equate to, Mike? You've been in that system.
A 9th and 12th grader.
9th and 12th.
Also,
still correlates across here. Never
Thank
really
you,
too sure. So realistically, they're saying... So realistically, they're saying 9 months per year they should be playing basketball. They should have 3 months off from basketball. And that's
and I would
kind of get to the point of college.
Agree with that, because if you had 3 months of physical prep in that time, it doesn't mean you stop, you sit on the couch and you stop doing stuff. But if you had 3 months of physical prep as your so-called pre-season, then into a, you know, heavy period of skill act, and then finish with probably 3 months of game and competition, that's a pretty good periodization model right there.
Pretty good.
Now, the other thing we didn't talk about with the VJBL is if it's 50 games of VJBL, it's probably another 50 games of school basketball, or it's domestic basketball, or it's something else. So, you know, our athletes in Victoria, there's 100 plus. The other challenge we've got is, like in country Victoria, if you're only a country athlete, you don't travel in for VJBL, you play tournaments. Those tournaments are lumped into one period of the year. So for 3-4 months, we're playing country tournament every weekend and that's it. Tournament model, not too bad, don't mind that. But then there's a period where they'll shut down and then go and do nothing for 6 months.
And some of that is because like the smaller country towns have football where pretty much
shut down.
The whole thing shuts down.
And there's
like,
football, there's cricket season, there's deliberate parts to it. So again, if we're talking about what is a perfect model on it, you know, to me, straight away, the mindset comes into that TAC Cup model that us three have had a little chat about, that if you had a 8-team competition, you hand-select the best athletes in the state to be a part of that, and it goes for it's a 10-week season or whatnot, and that environment's controlled by your high-performance program. Well, now, suddenly we are getting some specificity in how the style that they use and how they play and what they're doing.
Teaching continuity.
But then the rest of the time is skill up. So now we've actually got a balance and we could get into that world, which is something I think as a state, if we're really serious about producing the best athletes in Australia, that is something we've got to look at. You know, and to me, I'm a strong believer that we set things up pretty well for our athletes here. They don't need to go to Canberra to get better, right? But the thing that does scare me on it is if they do stay here, well, now they're competing to death, instead of actually getting what they need. And that's where Canberra still has the advantage at the COE.
Yep, absolutely. So we've touched a little bit on what the perfect model is. So how many times would you review your session plan and just sort of work out how much of your content is skill act, how much of it's competitive? Like, do you look at that at all over the course of the season or from week to week or not at all?
No, absolutely. Like, to me, I want to know how much time we've spent on shooting, how much time we've spent on ball screen D, et cetera, from a team environment. There is a great practice planner website that I'm actually hurriedly trying to remember the name of it right
no pressure,
now.
Mate. That's okay.
Practice Planner Live, which I know the COE guys put me onto it, and basically that will log all your drills. It'll also spit out how much time you spend on those things, so you can just over the course of the season, without even spending time on it, get some identification on what are you actually spending your time on.
Yep.
You know, 90% on 5-on-0, or actually doing some development. So that's been something that I've quite enjoyed of late, to just make efficiency a bit better.
Good job. So thanks, we yeah,
you know you're going well when you get props from Zeeple.
We recorded last Thursday, and we were talking Friday and Saturday. Excuse me. I went home Saturday after practice, and I reviewed the document that we give to all our NITP athletes. Like, what am I actually communicating with these kids and their families? And what I thought an important part of that was is, like, what do you want your athlete to look like at the end of the program? Because that'll certainly help you in your planning of everything, content, practice plans, drills. So if you say you want to develop the best screening player in your program, then you used to do a hell of a lot of screening drills. So I just think, you know, we talk about shooting ball being really important. Have a look at your practice plan. Does it actually allow for shooting the basketball to be a skill that can be developed and ultimately mastered at the end of your 3 years, 4 years with your athlete? And the drill, you'll get what you put into it. Like, if you put content into it and you can teach the content, then at the end of it, you'll get a result out of it. So I think you just got to start. Like, if you're the coach at XVJBL club, coaching the 16 ones, what do you want your athlete to look like in 12 months' time? Your practice plan and your content and your plan of what your 12 months looks like will dictate how that kid looks.
And we've spoken about this a lot within the office, and I don't think I'm speaking out of school when I say this. We talk a lot about who should make state teams. Is NITP directly linked to it as well, and talent ID that goes within that? And we would like to say that in a perfect world, there shouldn't be kids that make a state team that have not been through NITP or been identified. But they are two separate programs, because there are plenty of kids that get picked in NITP that don't make a state team, that just walk away from the game and say, well, you know, I wanted to make a state team, now I haven't, it mustn't be good for me. And it's like, well, you've got to take the long-term approach to this as a player as well. Just because you're not making an under-16 state team doesn't mean you won't make an under-20 state team or go on to be a pro. There are plenty of guys that have missed out.
And that's the other part too. So in reviewing that document, like, this player development pathway, and we won't call it NITP, we'll just say player development pathway, which takes place between, say, the age of 14 and 24. Like, what's the goal of that? The goal of that is to help an athlete get to a point in their life where they can play the game for money. That's it.
But then I would throw at you, state teams aren't high performance. State teams are elite.
That's why I didn't use the word high performance. Player development pathway is the goal is to have you make money. We were looking at the Northern Knights' aim and mission and vision and philosophy. Their philosophy and mission at the Northern Knights is to produce AFL players. And they outwardly put that on their website, in their documentation. Has nothing to do about producing TAC Cup champion teams.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the play development pathway. We're talking about becoming really good shooters, passers, catchers, pivoters, stoppers. That's what it is. To produce someone who at 24 can now have a meeting with someone, have to hire an agent so that they can talk about how much money you're going to make playing in the NBL, the New Zealand Basketball League, Europe, wherever we're talking, if we do the job. Now, it's hard to get a 14-year-old kid and a parent to understand that.
You know, the one thing, and the first NBL club that does this will actually control...
Don't give it away. Don't give it away.
Control development.
Remember who employs you, Justin. Yeah, I know there's about seven people, but one of them employs you just as much.
All seriousness, like, it's something we've discussed at length, but, you know, the European model has been a successful model for such a long time. Our nation for so long spent time looking at the US, and it was wrong. Like, it was absolutely wrong to be looking there and trying to figure out that's what we've got to get to. We're a club-based nation. So the first NBL club that actually set it up, that they had a junior representative club that went all the way through to a semi-pro club that then went all the way through to the pro club, we would have this,
own the market.
Have this model where they can actually spend time on developing athletes. If that was all under one roof, well, you know, bang, away you go. And you control how much. Then it's a money thing as well, where you don't have to be going and buying the best talent because you're producing the best talent.
You'll actually make money on it because someone's going to buy the rights to that athlete eventually.
And that ties in, say, episode 16 or 17, if I had to pluck it out of thin air, when we had Stacks on the show.
Yeah.
Like, the guys that he was getting in at 14, 15 years old to start training with the Crocs that have ended up becoming pros now. Yep. Like Mitch Norton's a great example. They loads of starting point guard in the league that got involved at the youth age because he was predetermined, didn't do the college thing, wanted to stay in Australia. But would he still be at the same point now without Stacks getting him in early? Hard to say, but I'd probably suggest no. Well, I don't think he'd be as good as you. Like, he's getting elite coaching at a young age. That's going to make you better.
No, regardless. No. I just really believe, you know, the more you work at different levels, the more I just keep thinking, God, if I could own something like that and set it up and be able to produce athletes from the day they walk into the door. And you know what? That under 12 program would be about fun and just let's play. No system. Let's just, it's about purely skill development. 14s, same deal, but now we're going to give you a little bit of ball screen so you can start evolving that. 16s, well, now we're going to start really getting you a holistic approach with your nutrition, with your, you know, S&C. With your physical development plan, etc., etc. 18s, you know what? If you're an under 18 in our club, well, we're going to contract you to this pathway now for semi-pro for the next 2 years, then graduate into the pro team. Like, it's not new. But the frustrating thing from our end is, like, you know, there is no opportunity for an athlete to do that in our country. And, you know, the again, the models that have the closest fit to that and the clubs that do have good linkage with those sorts of things and set up academies and whatnot, they really are in control of their own development pathway.
It was Melbourne Boomers do it a little bit here. They've got a number of girls now that were probably around about that college age that would usually go over to the States, that are still playing with Melbourne Boomers, but also have some university backing through Deakin as well. So they're probably fairly close, I would suggest, in that, well, do you need to go overseas to get your education, or can you do it here while still playing in a fairly good league?
I just look at Kilsyth, you know, like where I'm at, like, I just think it's almost there, you know? Like, if you could take care of the school component and have, you know, a bit of a... manage that and get more practice time with the athletes, and then, you know, there's a semi-pro team there already, and then if you had the resourcing to have that NBL program above, men's or women's or both, you know, that is the amount of kids we've got at a domestic level in that club. You can't tell me that if we actually manage that things couldn't be going in a great direction.
This sounds like a job interview. This is always agenda. You've
got too many jobs, mate.
I'm not sure Justin can fit another job in his schedule at this point. Right. He has enough problems getting to where he needs to be at this stage. It's a miracle that we get him here on a Thursday afternoon.
Ah, you do like, well. You do well. You're privileged.
So realistically, we've probably solved none of the problems. But again, if we can at least promote some discussion around this, and we're happy for you guys to send in your thoughts on this as well. Like, if you sit there and say, hey, you know what, I have the solution to all your problems, by all means, send it in. Because it is something that we're constantly looking at as well. I know the VJBL do have some flexibility around what they do as well and how they schedule games and how they manage it. Like, it's something that... That's a very serious statement. Yeah. No,
I wasn't sure.
Well, I mean, they started a little bit with under-12s, like how they regionalised the competition as well. Hasn't helped me. I'm still going to Geelong for the second time in 4 weeks. However, there is something there in place at least where it's, you know, they're starting to look at, well, okay, can we make this better? And I think change isn't to be feared. Like, I think it's a really good thing. And
it's healthy.
And it is also, I read something this morning where if everyone thinks the same, then you're not really thinking.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fairly valuable statement as well that we can look at.
Oh, and it's fair to say that we had a lot of discussion around this and we thought, well, we just need a review pod because of how much discussion came of it. So there might be a little bit of rehashing on areas we've touched in the past, but that's because we believe it.
Yep.
And you know, I think, again, if from this one there's a little bit more conversation, and then it's going to be about action and change. You know, words are words, but until the actions change, then... really, what are we doing?
Yeah, and without putting too much pressure on anyone, this is the most important issue
In
our sport.
Absolutely.
Like today, I have the conversation, like you guys have the conversation no short of a dozen times a week with different people around this thing. So it is something that we do need to come together as well. Like, we've got so many segments in Australia that we do need, and that's probably on us as well, is, you know, facilitating some of this to where we can have those hard discussions that will ultimately help the kid who is born today or this week have a hell of a career in 15, 16 years' time.
And, you know, I'd say a lot, there's nothing wrong with being the first. Like, if we are the first ones to really change that mindset and really just lock in on that, then I think that's a great thing. And you know, if we can, you know, in 12 months time when it's podcast number 88 or whatever it is, and say, you know, this is the change that's been made, that'd be a good day in my opinion.
It's a lot of editing and a lot of screwed up words of specification and specialising and those kinds of things. But again,
you started it.
It really is the high performance kids we're sort of talking about. There's nothing wrong with the level of participation we have. Like, absolutely, the groundswell at grassroots level is fantastic for everyone in basketball.
They go hand in hand. Eric said that last week. Like, high performance supports participation. Participation supports high performance. And they should all be able to, you know, sit side by side and work together. Because without one, you haven't got the other. Yep. But that is absolute.
It's a song about that,
isn't it? Oh, there might be. I'm not too
sing
sure.
It for us, mate. No, treat the audience.
You've got your mic. Off you go. So, split kick and extra. So I think,
Robbie, Justin, I've had some calls about this week.
Yeah, here we go. Okay, got it.
I've had some people, they're onto Robbie Shula. They reckon that you are trying to get Justin and I to shift and veer so far from our philosophies that you're jeopardising our jobs.
Did I call you on that, did I?
No, outside of this office.
To be honest, I dislike both of you, but I'm trying to get fresh faces on this one.
Well, have fun in Geelong again.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, mate. I'll give you a call on the way down there.
So, all right,
the
what
split
is it
for this week?
What is it?
So, Justin, you're pro on this, okay. I'm led to believe. Mike, you're negative on this.
Yep.
Defense wins championships. We see it thrown around a lot. It's one of those things that everyone sits there and says, yeah, you know, we're the best defensive team. We're going to win this. Is this true?
Yes. No. My argument with defense wins championships is as simple as this. If you can limit any team in the world to one shot, even if they make around, you know, a reasonable percentage of that, we're still in a great position to win the ball game. When we give out pre-game talks, I guarantee you there's defense written down first. This is what we're doing to cover the ball screen. This is what we're doing in the half court. This is how we're going to change and disrupt. The reason that is there is because it's about reducing the opportunity to put the ball in the hole. If we can do that more than the opposition can score, it's a guaranteed thing. We only need to score 2 points if they don't score any. All right, so defense definitely wins championships.
Was that based on your playing career, or is that just based on your coaching career now?
No, we try and make more threes than the opposition.
Mike?
Weak argument.
Furiously writing notes.
Weak argument. Defense wins championships. What do these three things have in common? Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, LeBron James. Minimal defense, plenty of offense, and offense wins championships. You can try to limit us to one shot, but if every one shot that we shoot goes in the hole, then you'll be taking the ball out of the net, inbounding it, and playing against a set defense every time. So I think you've all heard, yeah, you know, good offense beats great defense. That is true, mate. The only way that your argument will hold up is if you play against junk offensive players. But again, the best offense beats the best defense. And I think you even brought me an article maybe three or 4 months ago that said, it's kind of about scoring the ball.
That is 100% true. That's 100% true. I knew when that came up, I was waiting for you to say that. But for the listeners, there is a great article, and if I find it, I'll retweet it out, where it was about that, that exact term, does defense win championships or is great offense winning championships? And we are going into the United Finals campaign. That's when it came up, and that's why it was of interest to us. The one thing I will say, in the games we won in the NBL final series, we held Adelaide to low scores. That said, though, we use that D to transition into our O. So, you know, I think it is a hand-in-hand argument. Rob's done it to us again,
once
mate.
Once again. We'll see how much longer the split lasts.
By all means, you can take it off my hands. No problem. That's one less thing I need to think about every week. I'm all for it.
You think about like these questions?
Well, I think evidence would suggest probably not as much as I should. Kick, that is you, Mike.
Yep.
Two kicks this week, Robbie. Two kicks. The first one is I had to sit through Essendon and Carlton last Saturday afternoon. And
go
that
away.
Was abysmal.
Go away.
So that's my first kick. The second kick is I do have the podcast app on my phone. I just check in to see, make sure they get uploaded and just read the little The little blurbs. The blurbs are really, really good. I think Robbie writes those blurbs.
Robbie does.
Yeah, I rely on Freeman to put them up. He's a little bit late at times, so Freeman probably doesn't listen to this, so this doesn't matter. We can smack him.
This might come to as a bit of a shock to all our listeners, but there is one-star review on there, Robbie.
You're kidding me.
To the listener who I'm sure works for someone like Basketball New South Wales, remove it ASAP. But no, Robbie, just... we've got 50 people that have chimed in, and it's really good that we're reaching the audience. But seriously, no more one-star reviews, thank you.
We're sensitive.
The extra.
I've got the extra. You do. And woke up yesterday morning.
9:30.
Yeah, have a little scroll through Twitter, and all over it was about the Jordan documentary that's coming out. And for so long now, I've had arguments with young athletes trying to talk up LeBron as the GOAT, but they've never seen Jordan play. And what I hope that this 10-hour documentary, I think it's going to be featured on Netflix in conjunction with ESPN. I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it. Like, every time, you know, like, you have a bit of downtime, you can put those old Jordan videos on, you just go, this guy was unbelievable. Probably, for all of us, a big reason why we love the sport as much as we did. And just to see what they're going to do is going to be exciting. 250 hours of unseen footage.
Awesome.
So maybe a bit of casino action in there for him or on the golf course. But yeah, really excited. I think it's going to be something that helps his legacy continue for a generation that weren't lucky enough to see him. What it did get me thinking, though, is to appreciate LeBron James right now as well, because I heard it on a pod where someone said, you know, to be that lucky that you get to watch two of the all-time greats play, you know, that's a pretty fortunate period of time.
Absolutely.
A couple of things with that. One, it annoys me because I'm going to have to relive the Sam Bowie versus Michael Jordan draft, which Portland have inherently screwed up every time they've had a chance to get that right. Two, I'm really hoping they play that game that no one's ever seen just before the Barcelona Olympics.
The Olympics, that's like, another good doco, actually, if you...
like, there's plenty out there. Like, the Dream Team one is a really good one. Like, obviously, the 30 for 30s that were around, like the Once Brothers, was a really great watch as well. Like, there's so many great basketball documentaries out there.
Yeah.
This just adds to it. Like, and it's supposed to be like a 10-hour movie event. Like, that's a lot of basketball in there. So
a lot of hoops, man.
I've got a little bonus extra as well. Keep an eye out for Tommy Denner, MU, one of our media guys, has done a documentary on last year's final series. We got a little sneak peek of that
yesterday.
The Justin
Shaw story?
It's called Dreams and Nightmares. A little bit of internal meaning on that, but phenomenal. Like, so, you know, the one thing I do hope is that we get more and more Australian basketball documentaries, and that's something that I would definitely recommend having a little look on.
Also,
really well done.
Also on Netflix, will that be?
I'm not sure if it'll feature on Netflix, but I do believe it might be on Foxtel at some point. I don't know if I dreamt that or I heard that, but let's go with it.
Just like most things, just made
let's
up.
Go with it.
Yeah, so that wraps us up for this week.
Wrap
as always,
up, Robbie.
Thank you very much for listening, everyone. Thanks for all the reach outs, the text messages, the Twitter mentions, and things like that with you guys talking about last week's podcast. Again, the more interaction we get, one, the easier it is for us, and let's face it, that's what we're all about. But two, the more sort of discussion, I suppose, it promotes within basketball circles, the better. It's it really is a cool thing that we can walk into a stadium and say, hey, did you hear that podcast last night on player development or shooting or whatever it is? Like, it's a really cool space that we live in, and in the world of social media as well, where we can just have these basketball discussions. Mm-hmm. Like, 15 years ago, I had to rely on catching up with someone for a coffee somewhere and having that. So it's great to be able to do
this. The
other
thing I like is we're coming like Entourage, where people are wanting to come on the pod and have a chat. And if there's coaches out there that think they've got an angle and whatnot, I think that'd be great as well.
Thank you, Turtle.
That's kind of how Eric happened. And you know, that's something that's good for us as well, that if you think you've got something to offer that we haven't hit...
Yep.
We'll get you on.
Absolutely. And it was cool. I mean, last Friday night, I coached against one of our listeners who said, look, I knew we were in trouble when I walked in and saw you. And it's like, mate, I'm the least of your problems, believe me. These are under 12 kids. I have no control over what happens next. And Jason, you do still owe me your assessment for your association coaching course. I haven't forgotten. I will chase you down for that thing. But
Coach Jason.
Coach Jason.
Doesn't even sound made up.
Werribee boy.
There you go. Yeah, good. Do you want to give his address away as well?
Yeah, I can. But I mean, that is great to be able to have interaction with other coaches out there as well. And, you know, always happy to have a chat with someone. And, you know, if they want to pick our brains on something, I can't guarantee we'll have the answer or even
we'll make it up.
We'll make something up and it'll sound believable, like if nothing else. So we do appreciate people interacting with us. So again, if you can, like, retweet, share, do all those sorts of things that do promote the game, that's a good thing for everyone. So good luck with your coaching, and we'll chat to you guys next week.